amazed and taken aback at how unconcerned she was with her accomplishments and background, but I was still able to get a few things out of her. I got a basic rundown of where she went to school and what she does. She is a therapist in private practice, works in West LA. She did her master's at Pepperdine, her doctorate at USIU, United States International University, is that right? San Diego. And right now she's doing some postdoctoral work at UCLA. The research that she did during her doctorate was on the congruency of belief and sexuality among Mormon singles. She's been the past president of the, and I'll probably get, I won't say the abbreviation, it's the basically the Association of Mormon Therapists, right? She has three children, four grandchildren, six stepchildren, and 16 step-grandchildren. So you can see that she lives a very full life. Towards the end of our conversation, I saw that we overlooked where she got her bachelor's, and I said, well, where'd you get your bachelor's? And she said, Tulane. And I've only been to New Orleans twice as a tourist, and I said, wow, you chose that wonderful city to do your undergraduate and live to tell about it. For that alone, you deserve recognition. So, thank you.
I don't know if chose is exactly the right word. I was there living with my husband and at that time, you go to school where you are, and that's where I was. But Tulane is a wonderful school, and New Orleans is a fabulous city. So I think it's appropriate usually to say how much you appreciate being asked to do something like this. I don't know that I do. If you've come here for a great intellectual exploration, you may be disappointed. If you've come here for a great religious exploration, you may be disappointed. Neither one of those are my strong points. But I guess the one thing I do want to say is I want to thank my husband for daily asking me how my talk is coming, so I'm here. In our church, we have a belief. We have a belief that we had a pre-existence where we talked, we discussed, we were taught, we exchanged information, we evaluated, we weighed pros and cons, we had opinions, we had feelings, we disagreed, and we made decisions and reacted on those decisions. And during one particular period of time during that pre-existence, we participated in a council with our father, we assume our mother, and our two elder brothers, where a plan was presented, or plans were presented, as to what would happen when we came to this earthly existence and how it would be structured. Now, both of our elder brothers presented a plan, as we know, and both plans had exactly the same end goal. And we sometimes forget that Lucifer's plan did not contain any prohibition against goodness. He also wanted us to do and be good. He did not advocate anarchy or evil things that we now associate with him. He advocated a plan that had a guarantee of success. He promised that not one of us would fail to return to live in the presence of our father and our elder brothers. However, that plan had an underbelly of evil, and that was the fact of the evil of stifling choiceless conformity. His was a no-risk world where all things would be pre-decided and determined by him, where there's no diversity, no differences. We had to only unquestionably follow him, Lucifer. There would be no need for choices, no room for doubts, no place for questions, no tests of moral strength, no development of character, no growth of spiritual powers, no personal responsibility, no agency. But there would be safety. Now, one-third of our brothers and sisters liked that safety factor so well, they fought against our father when it was rejected. Now, Christ's plan did not have that same fail-safe provision in it, or those same fail-safe provisions. And we believe that we who now have mortal bodies chose his over Lucifer. We chose it because it allowed us to continue being active participants in the process of living, something we were enjoying at that time. And, of course, we chose it because we loved and respected our father, and it was the one that he chose. Anyway, once away from that environment, our choice of that plan has become more problematic. We had the privilege of making decisions, and we could decide, or in some cases, decide not to decide by not deciding and letting someone else decide. But one way or the other, in the end, we were going to be held personally responsible. And that is the rub. In our heart of hearts, we usually demand the right for agency. But we want the safety, particularly the non-responsibility of Lucifer's plan. Now, we're all challenged when it means being responsible for every choice. So I'd like to take a moment and have you think of a time where you made a choice where you're fully aware that you did not want to be responsible for the consequence. Tag it into your mind for just a minute. And at the same time you're thinking of this choice, or you're planning to do this particular choice, you are planning how you're going to not be held responsible. You've got it all worked out in your mind how you're going to avoid it. Now take a second time and think about a choice you made where you wanted to make a choice, and as you're doing it, there's a rationalization attached to it for why you made it. Then a third type of choice, which is harder for maybe you to think of, but maybe if you really search you can come up with one, is where you made a choice, but you didn't know you were making it. It was so much a part of you that it was just automatic. Got some in your mind? Now let me give you some example. Let me give you one example for all three. We'll use the same example. Let's take the choice of criticism. You want to criticize, but you don't want the blame for criticizing. So what you do is you say at the end of it, "I was just joking." Right? You've just taken your choice of criticism and tossed it over here and actually handed it to the party you criticized because you were just joking. It's theirs now, all in total. Let's take the same thing where you rationalize away. What do you say at the end of it? It's for your own good. Something, I hate to tell you this, but you need to know. It's for the best. But the last one, where we don't know, are the hardest because we're usually offended and hurt when someone points out we've done these because we feel perhaps we have spoken in a normal tone of voice, perhaps we feel like we've presented in a very nice way, where in fact it has been hurtful and painful for the person hearing the criticism. That's when we're doing it. We have no awareness that we're doing it. It's a part of us. And it's because our life experiences have gotten us to a point where our perception is dulled. We are not aware of what we're doing. Now, I use the example of criticism because it's universally done. We're all guilty of it sometimes. I don't know anyone who doesn't criticize at times. And yet none of us, I bet if I went around the room, none of us like to be thought of as a critical person. That is a very negative thing in our society. We don't want to be thought of as a critical person. But you could plug anything into those three examples that you want. You could plug in affairs. You could plug in cheating. You could plug in word of wisdom issues. You could plug in lying. Any one of those three types of methods of avoiding responsibility would work for anything that you plan, want, and sometimes do. So you can see what I'm talking about when I'm talking about today, talking about personal responsibility. I'm not talking about I am a Mormon, taking responsibility for being that, or, you know, I am no longer believed, Joseph Smith's story. I'm not talking about these big global things. I am talking about our day-to-day, hour-to-hour, living our lives. and taking responsibility for how we do that. Now, to talk about personal responsibility, I think we need to see it as a very dynamic operational factor in our lives. It works every moment we are in existence. So let's talk about it as taking accountability, and let's say it's the ability of the self to respond or act. And in our case, we're going to expand that just a little bit and say it's the ability of the self to respond or act in a manner congruent with our beliefs, the ability to respond or act with courage to what our life serves up to us, those happenings that we have no control over, the ability to respond or act with self-discipline and self-control, the ability to respond or act with honesty to both successes and failure of choices, and the ability to respond or act to God's promptings and inspirations. Now, in this mortal state, there are two main sources of problems with being personally responsible. The first main source, and if you could kind of imagine as I start to describe these things, could you imagine soil? This is the soil. There are two things in our soil. One is immaturity. The first is immaturity. Many individuals are immature, emotionally and spiritually. I love Lavinia Fielding Anderson's quote where she said, "I like to hear children sing, 'I am a child of God.' I don't like to hear adults sing it. Everyone is a child of God. The hard part of is becoming an adult of God. Most of us get stuck in being an adolescent of God. We whine, we sulk, we have spurts of devotion and conformity, followed by either rebellion or terminal sloth. We're dependent, frightened, arrogant, and insecure. And we want someone to tell us what to do, but then we get mad when they tell us." Does that sound like any adolescents you know? That's us. But for many people, life experiences have been such that they are so intimidated by being adult that they see it such an overwhelming burden and so daunting, they consciously, but most of them unconsciously, decide to stay emotionally children and spiritually children or adolescents. So that's part of our soil. The other part of our soil, the second really big underlying reason, is poor self-esteem. I know that's kind of a catchphrase of the 70s and 80s, but nonetheless, it's a real thing. It's our image of ourself. It's how we value and feel about ourselves based on the interaction of our temperament and all incoming information since birth, and some even believe since conception. The level of our self-esteem determines our cycles of behavior that in turn weaken or strengthen us. Now, poor self-esteem probably underlies all other things, all other blocks to our taking personal responsibility for our moment-to-moment choices. When we feel bad about ourselves, we feel unempowered. We don't feel like we have the power to be responsible. It's easier to point to something outside of us as a source of a problem of pain rather than acknowledge how our exercise of agency has caused or contributed to that pain. Now, out of these roots of immaturity and poor self-esteem, I would like you to imagine, or out of this soil, I'd like you to imagine three roots. And I'm taking these three main ones. It's three roots of fear. There are other fears than just these three, but there are three main ones that affect our 20th century society and Mormons in particular. The first fear is fear of pain. Second one is fear of failure. And the third one is fear of not being acceptable. So let's start with thinking about these three fears. Now, I'm going to talk about them in a minute, but fears bring up anxiety. Fears create anxiety within all of us. If we have a fear, there's an anxious feeling that happens in our body. That, in turn, causes the development of defense mechanisms. Now, I assume all of you have heard of that term, defense mechanisms. It's a Freudian term. But Anna Freud, his daughter, actually wrote about them. And what I'd like to do is kind of define defense mechanisms so we know what we're talking about here. A defense mechanism is a strategy used by the ego to reduce the anxiety we feel. By concealing the source of the anxiety, both from ourselves and from others. Got that? I mean, does that make sense? And we all use defense mechanisms. I mean, we all have them. And we use them constantly. Because if we didn't, we'd be psychologically disabled. We'd be non-functioning. Because they conceal knowledge that if we had that in our consciousness, there's the hungers of the id, there's the condemnations of the superego, there's the traumas and the darkest feelings from our childhood that get covered over by defense mechanisms, that if they were all just barreling forward all over us, we would be immobile. We'd all be in hospitals and they'd be drugging us and we'd just be sitting there doing that. So in general, defense mechanisms can be seen as something adaptive and productive in our life. However, in some cases, they have the opposite effect. And that is that they interfere with our adaptive functioning. Instead of being a help, they block us. And very frequently, we bring them from our childhood. The ones we bring from our young childhood usually are maladaptive. They worked when we were kids. It worked to sit on the floor and kick and scream and cry when we didn't want to do something. It does not work as an adult. Now, that's kind of a simplified idea of a defense mechanism. But things that work then don't work as adults. They're not adaptive for adults. And the other thing to remember why most of them that we bring from childhood are not adaptive is that our ego is tied up in maintaining them. We're constantly working on making sure it stays in place. If I fear you getting close to me, I'm going to be constantly finding ways to keep you a little bit away, you know, that are kind of not seen. I'll be doing it more like this. And but that takes energy. So I'm not going to have energy to be learning about how to love you. My energy is going to be so caught up in keeping my defense mechanism going, my defense mechanism in place, that I'm not going to have the energy left to do those things that we want to be able to do in order to have our spiritual growth being continued. So I wanted to kind of give you that idea of what a defense mechanism is and goes. The main ones are pretty well defined in literature, and I'm just going to list them really quickly, but where there are millions of defense mechanisms, the main few are repression. That's where we actually push it down out of the way, forcing it back under the unconscious. Projection is where I give it, put it on you. You know, I may be parent, I may be really a someone who is not trustworthy, so I'm always watching out for you because I'm sure that you're going to cheat me. Displacement is that we actually, the boss is angry at us, we come home and kick the dog. I mean, we all know displacement. We do that all the time. Denial, we refused. You know, it's way down four, we refuse it. Reaction formation is where we go actually the opposite of what it is. We invest in the opposite of what our issue is. Rationalization, we all know, we do that all the time. Intellectualization, does that sound familiar to anyone at Sunstone? Fixation, inabilities to progress beyond a certain point. We see this sometimes. Do you ever meet up with people who you feel like, gee, their behavior is kind of odd? And if you really investigate it or if you really look at it closely, you see that they're fixated at maybe in an adolescent stage somewhere or something where they've had a trauma, a big trauma, and they emotionally have not grown beyond that point. Regression is where we've actually grown beyond that point and something happens in our life and we go back. Most of us regress a little bit when we're sick. What is your first instinct when you get sick? You want to go to bed, you want mom to put a nice cold rag across our forehead and kind of nurture us. That's adaptive regression, but that's what we're talking about, regression. And sublimation is where you turn away from unacceptable objects, you know, aggressive instincts and such, to acceptable objects. It's okay. I'm really very angry at my father, but it's okay. I can't say that to him, but it is okay for me to say I'm very angry that the government's not doing well. You know, I can just really invest in something else. So that's what we're talking about in general defense mechanisms. But let's look at a few specific, and maybe you could think of some as we go along. What about the fear of pain? What about Mormons and the fear of pain? How are we with pain as a culture?
Honestly, I can't say anything fair.
We have an idea. I mean, unlike some of the Protestant religions who have as part of their belief system that there should be pain and suffering, we don't believe that. We believe in joy and wonderful, and everything's supposed to be good because we live good lives and we get blessings, therefore, thereof, and therein. So if we have pain, we're not good with pain as a general principle. We're not into pain, thank you very much, either emotional or physical. So what would be some defense mechanisms that we as Mormons might use to not feel pain? I heard one something. What?
Prozac.
One of the more adaptive of the maladaptive. Endless cliches. Yes. Right. Repression. How about a... Okay, go ahead. Yes, Molly Mormon. Yes, Patty Perfect. Yes, how many of us gone up against her and come out the loser? Okay, what about escapism? In our culture, how many Mormons are addicted to things? Are we workaholics? Are we a group of workaholics? Have you ever seen a bunch? What about foodaholics? Do we eat ourselves? When we feel anxiety, that's the first thing. You know, when I'm anxious, my hand's in that fridge just as fast as it can go, and I don't even know I've gotten there. That's right. What about churchaholics? Do we have any of those in our religion? Where they actually, you know, it's so much a part of them. Well, addictions numb us to stimuli. Addiction numb us to feelings. If we're addicted, we don't feel. Because as the feelings come up, that makes us anxious. We numb it with our addiction, whatever it is. You had something you wanted to add?
Just compartmentalization is a mechanism also that we use.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Something else. What about apathy and indifference? How many of us go into that? How many of you voted this last week? Don't raise your hands. How many voted this last week? Apathy and indifference play any role in you're not doing that? Possibly. And why are we apathetic? Because we feel we have no real say. We feel powerless, that our vote really, that it really won't change, so why go and worry about doing that? Not that we think that much about it, but anyway, apathetic and indifference. Indifference and apathy also occur when we fear that what we choose is dangerous to ourselves, either in a financial, physical, or social way. Eli Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winner, said this: indifference to me is the epitome of evil. The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of art is not ugliness, it's indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it is indifference. And the opposite of life is not death, it's indifference. Because of indifference, one dies before one actually dies. To be at the window and watch people being sent to concentration camps or being attacked in the streets and do nothing is to be dead. Now, that's strong, but that's pertinent to us. Are we indifferent when it comes to fearing something of our safety in any of those ways, social, physical, or financial? What about plain old laziness? How does that affect personal responsibility? I see a woman, and her situation has got lots of things in it, but her son, who's an adult, has come home to live. He's come home to live because he wants some quality time with his mother. And now for the last 2 years, he's been having this quality time. She works. He doesn't. She pays the mortgage. He doesn't help. She cleans the house. He doesn't. She buys the food and prepares it. He doesn't. He does have people over if she, and is very upset if she doesn't want to prepare food for them. Now, there's a number of things going on with this young man, but one of them is he's just plain lazy. She'll do everything, so why should he? And he kind of resents her asking him he gets really mad if she asks him to do things and won't do them. He just ignores it and doesn't do it. But he's protecting himself. Why should he do it if she will do it? It's easier to be less responsible if someone else will be responsible. Now, lazy individuals usually have been overindulged as children, and that's why they're lazy, and he's certainly, this is what we're working on with her, but it takes a lot of courage to throw your son out when you're afraid you'll lose his love by doing so. But that those are her issues, and that is not about what we're talking about. So these are some of the things about avoiding pain. We don't like emotional pain. We don't like physical pain. We don't like pain. What about the fear of failure? Do we, as LDS people, fear failure? Is that one of our big deals? This is a success-oriented church. We have successful business people in it. We have successful, people who have made the church their career. They are successful people. We're success-oriented. So to be seen as a failure, to be judged as a failure, or to feel yourself as a failure, is a very difficult thing in our society. And so very difficult for us to be responsible for our decisions and be seen as a failure. You can see how that would be a tremendous fear. What is a reaction formation to failure? Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Withdrawal. You're saying withdrawal. Rather than be seen as something, we withdraw from the playing field. If we're not going to be successful, I'm not going to play. If I don't win, I don't play. You withdraw from the field. We don't see people we want to see. We remove ourselves from relationships if we don't feel like we're going to actually have their approbation. Various things like that. You're talking about withdrawal. Yes.
Well,
he went out and it was a hard world.
Yeah.
And he got buffeted about and was really in. I mean, yes, he's afraid. He's also lazy, but he's also afraid. He really is afraid. What is perfectionism? Isn't that investing in exactly the opposite of what you're fearing? That was reaction formation. Perfectionism is reaction formation. I don't want to fail, so I'm going to be perfect. Perfect to the minute detail. And it, when carried to that kind of extent, it is to the minute detail. You watch people being caught up in just teensy tiny things, and you think, let it go, let's move on. No, it's got to be right, perfect. The drawer has to be absolutely straight before we can leave the house today. What about the need for power and control? Where does that come from, do you think? From fearing failure. If we're in control, or if we have the power, if we're in charge, we set the pace, we aren't failing. We are not failing. Any others that you can think of that might be?
Rationalization.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Criticism.
Yes. Criticize. Point it out there. Mm-hmm.
Try to find a reason why somebody else failed because it would be too scary to think that it might happen to us.
Yes. Yes. We do too much investigatory type things. Let's make sure we're not like them. Da 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 da. Yes.
Casting everything to the external, making it everything—it's everybody else's fault.
Right. That putting it out there. It's not us. It's very hard for us to take responsibility. I chose the wrong career. I'm not good at what I chose. It's hard to put that in. I really am not adapted to what I chose. Those sorts of things, very hard. Anything else? Well, let's take the third fear that's a big one in our community, and that's the fear of not being accepted. Let's include in that general thing the fear of being different, the fear of being abandoned because we're not accepted. Tell me about, what do you think about Mormons and not being accepted? Do we have a lot of problem with that? How does it feel to go to your meetings and know in your heart of hearts that you don't agree with what's being said, something that's being said, or you don't fit what's being said? Singles, when you go to Relief Society and it's all on family and marriage and children, and you sit there and you get littler and littler and littler inside, and it hurts. What about that? What about being gay and going and hearing something from the pulpit that so explicitly excludes you? How does it feel? It doesn't feel good, and we don't like feeling that way. You know, there's the thing about groupthink. I don't know if you remember in the Kennedy years during the missile crisis, Kennedy set up a council of all of his advisors, and they met, and he was really concerned about this idea of groupthink. It's a political term, and for it, trying to get everyone to think the same. So he deliberately assigned someone to always take the opposite view, so they always had to have someone in the room that would absolutely had to say what was opposite what the group was trying to do. You see, if the military people were really pushing, let's go in, let's bomb them, let's get them in, you know, smash them flat, he insisted there was always someone in the room when they were discussing to take it, for fear that they would be carried away by the wall wanting to be included, no one wanting to be the outsider. And it's really easy to have that happen to us in church. How many times have you sit there and gone like that when you felt like that? You know, it's very hard not to be part of the group. And here again, one way to be able to manage that anxiety that produces is the one that you mentioned, is withdrawal. Okay? I won't feel bad if I don't go to church. If I'm not there, I'm not going to feel these bad feelings anymore. I withdraw. I withdraw from the group. What about going the opposite? Prideful, arrogant, conceited, snobbish. Well, they just don't have all the information I have. They don't read, obviously. You can tell they don't read. Or they don't study this principle of the gospel, or they, whatever. I mean, we can go the opposite extreme. What about pessimism or negativity? Do we have that as a defense against not feeling part of? Well, I don't care. Not going to happen anyway. It doesn't make any difference anyway. You know what the world is like. It's blank and you die. That's the saying, isn't it? You had something you want to say?
Right.
Any? I thought I saw a hand over here. No? Sure. Okay.
To what extent do you think that people sit there and rather than question the expectations, they say,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And here we are back to self-esteem. Who else could, you know, why else would there be? Why am I? It must be me. I can't see where the piece is missing, but it's obviously missing because I don't fit. I don't belong here. I'm on the edge. Yes?
If you don't have the strength to maintain that something's wrong with me and live with it, so there is a tendency to start minimizing the validity of whatever it is you are not.
Yes.
At ease with.
Yes. That's right. That's right. We have to, it's dissonance. We have to find some way to lessen the dissonance when the material coming in is so different from the material inside. If we're giving information that doesn't fit our construct, we have to do something to lessen the dissonance because we cannot live with dissonance. And that's what you're saying. We either have to negate ourselves or we negate what's coming in order to do it. The adaptive way is to integrate, which is hard to do, especially if it's diametrically opposed, but nonetheless. Now, what about blind obedience? Is that a way to be accepted? Okay, I'm obviously wrong. I'm just going to do what they say and believe it. And you really do. You really get into it. Now, since this is Sunstone, I'm assuming you all know this, but just in case you don't, I am going to give it to you one more time. The Mormon myth on obedience that causes so much difficulty for us all started way back in 1945. And it came from a quote that said, "When our leaders speak, the thinking has been done." And that's not maybe when we started, but that's the quote that it gets quoted or misquoted or changed. You know, Elaine Cannon said it, "When the prophets speak, the debate is over." Anyway, that whole thing. What happened at that time was that there was a clarification and rebuttal in December of that same year by the prophet George Albert Smith. Now, when people refer back to this, they neglect to refer back to his clarification / rebuttal, which I want to read to you just so that I make sure everyone knows it. So that when you hear this, you can know in your heart, wait a minute, I know something more, and that's not exactly correct. He wrote, "The leaflet to which you refer and from which you quote in your letter was not prepared," and that's in quotes, "by one of our leaders." That's in quotes. He's quoting the person that wrote him. "However, one or more of them inadvertently permitted the paragraph to pass uncensored. By their doing so, not a few members of the church have been upset in their feelings, and the general authorities have been embarrassed. I am pleased to assure you that you are right in your attitude that the passage quoted does not express the true position of the church. Even to imply that members of the church are not doing their own thinking is grossly to misrepresent the true ideal of the church, which is that every individual must obtain for himself a testimony of the truth of the gospel, must through the redemption of Jesus Christ work out his own salvation, and is personally responsible to his Maker for his individual acts." Now, this is a clear repudiation of the idea of not thinking or of blind obedience. You know, Christ loves someone who is obedient, but he loves someone who is obedient through choice, that through thoughtful choice. And it is only by a choice and by the factoring in of all information that you can appropriately obey, that you can know what to obey. Otherwise, we've bought Satan's plan. Falling under this same blind obedience category, what about reliance on overregulation? Do we follow rules too much? Isn't that why we're known for joining things like FBIs and stuff? Isn't that why Mormons are known to be good functionaries in corporate? That's why they solicit them. We obey. We follow the rules. We do what is expected. We will follow rules and questioning. We make really good soldiers. No, because we will follow. Yes.
I'm the only woman in the Christian department at the high school where I teach, and I was specifically hired because it was assumed that as a woman I would not make friends. Unfortunately, not true. The head of the department expressed his dismay at the fact that I didn't follow his expectations.
Oh yes, see, she broke the rule. Well, we tend to be rule followers. And if we're rule followers, we're following someone else's decision, and we're going to be responsible for their choice instead of our choice when we have to report on our lives. And we need to remember that. At the opposite end of blind obedience, what about blind resistance? Do any of us fall into that category where we resist requests, suggestions, directives, just because we are not going to be told what to do? And what about intellectualization? We mentioned that here. Do any of us have that problem? It would be hard to think that someone at Sunstone would be to use intellectualization as a defense mechanism, would it? problem for that end of the spectrum is that there's too much personal and not enough exercise of the ability to respond to God's promptings. And we have to make sure we keep that balance. Otherwise, we'll be out of balance one way or the other way. Now, all three fears of pain, of not being accepted, of failure, can result in resentment, rage, and anger. These global defenses we're all vulnerable to. And we can't make good decisions and be honestly responsible for them if we're filled with rage or resentment or anger. We just cannot do it. It clouds us. It's like having... how many of you wear contacts? And your contacts glaze over sometimes and it's cloudy? Well, we cannot. It clouds our soul. They cloud our soul if we have rage, resentment, or anger. So if you find you're angry very often, if you're carrying rage or resentment over long periods of time, that's a red flag. Right, plain and simple, there's no other thing, it's a red flag. You need to work on it. There's something there you've got to work on. You've got to look at and take care of. Because otherwise, you are going to have choices made where you think you're being responsible, and you're going to miss the mark a lot because your soul is cloudy. Now, going on the assumption that anyone that
question.
Would...
Question.
Oh, sorry.
It seems like we need to speak to the idea that we have been so culturized, whatever, that we don't even know when we're angry.
Sublimation, if we push it down.
Yeah.
It's not, especially women in
women
our thing. Yes, it is. Did you want to comment on that? Yes.
Do you differentiate between rage and anger?
Think of a continuum. Think of a continuum. You start with resentment, and there's various other things. Anger, rage. So it's like that. Yes, in our society as Mormons, you know, we think about the Western heritage and we think about, you know, gunslingers and all that sort of thing, and that men did their thing. But we don't have that for women. We don't have the even the cultural background of saying, yes, they worked out their fights in the saloons and on the streets of Dodge. It's very hard to recognize when you're angry if you've been taught to numb out. And a lot of us have been taught to numb our feelings. We numb it out, and we are not in touch with the amount of anger. And the thing that will be a clue is you'll find yourself bopping along, and something will happen, and instead of being irritated, which is on this continuum, which is about the right level for what went on, you are going to be furious. That should ring a bell for you. If you note that in good common sense this deserves irritation and it's getting furious, you've got some anger you're not in touch with and it's coming out. It's like a garbage can. You keep pushing in and you push it in and you push it in, and you slam that lid down, and when you go, and then at odd times it comes popping out and you just at the wrong time. You know, you want to put one little thing in and all of a sudden you've got all this out. Yes.
There's another thing which is kind of our self-deception, I think. When you do it, it's rage. When I do it, it's righteous indignation.
That's true. Isn't that true? Now, on the assumption that individuals... Yes?
Is depression a form of repressed anger?
Yes, very often. It can be. When we don't do our anger, we repress it. Depression comes from helpless, hopeless. It's hopeless, and I'm helpless to do anything about it. It's not that we think that, to be honest. We don't think that. But that is what's inside of us. We're in a spot that there is no way, and it's depression. Now, this is saying it's depression from the outside sources. There's also depression that is biologically predetermined or predisposed, and that we have to take into account, too, and should not be put in the same kind of category. But yes, anger turned inward is depression. And so instead of putting it down, and so women, you know, we have a high percentage of women who have depression. Could it be that their anger's turned inward? Someone keep watching the time with me.
Yeah, we have time.
We're doing fine?
Yes, we have like 10, 12
okay.
more minutes.
On the assumption that people who choose to have a sunstone are quite well developed on the personal responsibility scale, I brought a little quiz for you to check it out. Now, my experience with this is that those very same defenses from truly being responsible will tend to color how we answer questions and may skew your results. So take a quick look and just kind of do it in your head. If you want to do it with pencil, that's okay. What we're looking for here is well, it tells you, the little score thing is down there at the bottom. But remember, what is important to remember is as you read these, it's not what your score ends up, it's what you felt. So read through them, and as you feel, note what you feel. Are we doing okay? Were there any more? Did you run out? No, I don't.
No more.
No. I made 60. If you want those that if someone didn't get them, if you'll just give me your name, I'll make sure you get one. We'll get some copied off today. I'll make sure you get them. Or sit by someone so you could read it. What we're talking about here is just a little tiny guideline. Is are you doing it sometimes, always, rarely, or never? And usually we will fall into the sometimes category. But I think what you need to be aware is that the very thing that would make you say sometimes may be the same thing that is keeping you from truly being responsible, and you may be in denial, or you may be repressing, or you may be having some defense mechanism that will keep you from actually being honest with yourself. Now, a good problem usually requires some sort of solution, even if it isn't a good solution, and so we have to talk about how we can be more personally responsible. So I'm going to give you some thoughts on that. It was not all inclusive, obviously, but I'm going to give you some thoughts on it. It may be a cliche, or it may feel like a start of a sacrament meeting talk, but we truly have to begin by enlisting God's help. We cannot be personally responsible if we don't include His promptings. We just cannot. So we have to start there. Then, following that, you have to do your personal footwork, what we call your personal work. You have to do your real work of wanting to change those defense mechanisms and to alleviate those fears and to grow spiritually and emotionally so that you can truly be responsible for choices you're making on your day-to-day living. So you have to start by evaluating yourself in a very dispassionate way. Now, when I say evaluate, I mean dispassionate. I don't mean judge. You have to note what makes you you. You have to observe and contemplate. It's the totality of what we are that's important. Again, Lavinia Fielding Anderson, who has these marvelous things that she said, I realized, she was saying someone had been thanked for being shy, and she said she realized at that moment that she'd always assumed that the Lord had only wanted her strengths, her abilities, and her competencies, and it had not occurred to her that the qualities that she considered unique idiosyncrasies, or even weaknesses might be wanted or useful to him. And so she was wrong, and she said she in wrongful humility was withholding those from consecration. So know that your weaknesses as well as your strength are important to God for some reason, and you may not know why. But evaluate yourself as honestly as you possibly can, and that is, in the 12-step programs they call it a fearless and complete moral inventory or something like that. It's kind of scary. But we need to do that. And then you need to write down those characteristics that keep you from taking responsibility and the barriers that you have to changing them. What keeps you from changing these things? If you recognize that, if we go back to that original criticism example, and you recognize that this is one of your vulnerabilities, consider some of the reasons why. Which fear is it based on? Are you afraid of being different, and so you criticize the other person in order to feel better than or at least equal to? Do you fear failure, and so you throw out criticism to someone else rather than feel so bad about yourself? And what defense mechanism keeps them in place? Is it pride? Is it anger? Is it indifference? What kinds of things are keeping these your behaviors that are keeping you from being personally responsible rolling? What keeps them going? And just a little clue, if more than one person happens to mention something about you or something you are doing, you might want to look at it, because there might be some validity to it, just maybe. So it'd be well to take a look. Now, sometimes this is pretty hard to do. I'm a therapist, so obviously I'm fully in favor of getting outside help if you need outside help. Enlist temporary help if you need it of professionals. Don't misunderstand the use of professionals in your life. They are valuable. Be they doctors, lawyers, mechanics, plumbers, medications, or other helpful individuals or professionals. Use the things, the tools that we have in our lives available to us now. And the issue for you is to make as good a judgment on it as possible by choosing who, what, where, and when to use these tools, as opposed to relying on them 100% of the time. Another thing to do on this to help you be more personally responsible is to increase your acts of self-love and increase your affirmations of self-worth. And that is to say your divinity. Carol Lynn Pearson had that wonderful little short poem about, you know, God, all creatures pass in front of God and you call them all good. I don't know exactly how it goes, but it's just a little tender thing. And we were called good by God. And yet we say how stupid I was. Oh, I can't imagine why I did such a dumb thing. You know, those kinds of things. We say these things to ourselves all the time, and they go in, and they become part of the whole. But we don't ever say, gee, I did that really well. Gee, that was quite a nice thing. We don't say those things to ourselves. Now, you probably aren't going to go around doing that just because I said increase acts of self-love. But think about positive things. Give yourself positive self-loving gifts. What is a self-loving gift? Who has a self-loving gift? Anybody know of a self-loving gift? What does a massage do for you? Have you ever had a massage? Oh! Self-loving. Very tender. Hands-on. It's healing. Hands-on things are healing. What about certain music? Self-loving? Do we listen to it? Yes. What's a self-loving? Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's right. Invest in the moment of the beauty of the moment, wherever it is. Yes. Okay. Something you gave yourself that you've denied yourself before. Yes, Marianne? Well, there's two or three things.
I mean,
Okay, stupid is different than cruel, obviously. But if you have done something that has hurt someone else, you take responsibility by taking care of that, by A, addressing it with them, repairing it as best you can, and refraining from doing it again. the act of repentance, in essence, the changing of the heart. Foolish things we all do. There we have to look at ourselves like God looks at us. Think about having a child that does something foolish. What do you feel for them? You think, oh, you poor thing. Oh, dear. Yeah, that's okay. Next time you'll do it better. I know you'll do it. That's fine. Do we do that to ourselves when you do something foolish? That's how God would do it to us. You poor, you know, that's okay. It's all right. I know you're learning. Next time you'll do it better. But when we do it to ourselves, I can't believe this. Oh, you know. Yes, idiot. Dumb. You know, the cat of nine tails is out across both shoulders, fast as it can go. We have to be more loving to ourselves. We have to imagine, what would God say to me right now? What would he say at this moment? Oh, I'm so sorry you did that. How can I help you fix it? I'm so sorry you made that choice. What can we do together to work it out? As opposed to the mean, angry, punitive thing. Yes?
We have to accept that love is okay. And when the person happens, we'll call it self-care. And we've been so indoctrinated that loving ourselves is self-centered.
Yeah.
Selfish is wrong, and we have to rework that.
But self-centeredness, you know, isn't self-love. It's the opposite. It's self-hate. We have to pump ourselves up by being better than. That's, you know, it's a reaction formation. Okay. Seek relationships that enrich your life. How many of us stay in relationships with friends or family that are really destructive? Well, a lot of us. So, this is hard to figure out, but the thing you have to figure out is, what are you doing that perpetuates the destruction? That's being personally responsible. And you look at your half of what you're doing, and you do your best that you can do to change your half. Be it just responding. I mean, you may be with a toxic person, and they just may be full of rage for whatever of their history is. And you may be getting a lot of that, but you respond in some manner. You know, you may not be, you know, you just may be an innocent bystander, but you have to respond in some manner, and you can make a choice about how you respond. But if you make choices about how you respond, and things over time don't change, remove yourself from those relationships. Distance yourself. Make some space. Because life is too short to be abused by anyone. And God would not have us do that. He wants us to be loved and loving. Seek out those relationships that emanate peace in your life. There are friends that give you peace, that give you a calm feeling, that give you tranquility when you're with them. And there are friends, when you're with them, you feel a little anxious, you're a little on edge, you're on guard. Seek out the ones that give you the peace. At least counterbalance those that don't. At minimum, give yourself that. And then lastly, I would suggest, you know, this morning Albert Peck was giving, in his devotional, gave us these wonderful words about Robert Frost, and he said, way leads to way. What you immerse yourself in leads you down your path. And I would say, study the life of Christ. And try your best to emulate his behavior. Now, I know we're constantly exhorted to study the scriptures. I am not talking about that. That's well and good for its own reasons. I'm talking about the life of Christ. Only the life of Christ. Look at his life. Who was he? What did he do? How did he do it? Study it, study it, study it. Emulate it as best we can in our real mortal frail ways. That will help us with taking personal responsibility. That will really help us. We're told all the time that we are responsible for our salvation, and that we will answer to God for our choices. I personally believe most of our choices have earthly consequences. and the eternal consequence is that it pulls us off the course of being more Christ-like. And that in the end, when we face Christ, we will have to say how we've loved, and that will be what we'll be asked. And that everything that we do here that keeps us from learning that attribute is the problem we need to be working on. Anything that keeps us from doing that. And that all of these commandments or these rules and regulations that are for our good are things that should be keeping us on track of learning how to love as Christ loved. But we certainly aren't going to be able to get up and say to God, well, I heard it in a meeting, or I heard it at a symposium, or I read it in the Ensign, or I read it in dialogue, or this authority or that anti-authority told me, for explaining why we didn't learn to love. And I will disclose with this little thing from the prophet Micah. And speaking of God, he hath showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee? But to do justly and to love mercy.
Our time is up, but nobody's coming in. So, do we want some comments, Wayne?
I have a question. Within the church, of course, the first line counseling tends to be a bishop, relief society president, and so forth. As someone who's a trained psychotherapist, what do you think is the most valuable contribution they can make?
They give moral support. First of all, they give moral support and love. I think that's the first line of thing. A true bishop is loving of his flock, and he will love you and care about you, as does his helper, the Relief Society president. Their calling is for your spiritual well-being. And some of the things we talked about have to do with emotions, have to do with things we learned or were taught as children. Some of them are trained and well-equipped to handle that, and some of them are not. But if you have a spiritual thing to address, you turn to a spiritual professional. And that would be, I think, your bishop and your Relief Society president where it's appropriate. But mainly, it's that they care about you and that they love you. It's mainly, I think, their role in our lives. Yes. That's a really good idea. Is everyone hearing what he's suggesting? Yes. Gene is suggesting a study group meeting. A group that you feel safe and comfortable with. First of all, that you can feel the love for each other, and study together will help fill this self-love need. And a growth need as well. Not being accepted, fear of not being accepted. What she's asking is our study groups or support groups found on by the church. I have no idea if they are or they are not. I think support groups, as a professional, support groups are fine as long as they're not destructive. You have to make sure your support group is constructive, and sometimes support groups get the idea you're supposed to get in there and help everybody get their problem taken care of, and they start in criticizing. So if you have a support group, what you do in your support group is you have a kind of a contract. You say these are our parameters, and if someone starts into the critical mode, you tenderly remind them, remember our contract. Our contract is supportive, positive, uplifting. If it doesn't uplift, if it doesn't support, if it doesn't help facilitate growth, then we should reconsider whether we should be saying it. And a support group's wonderful. You know, a women's support group, yeah, it would be great. Yes, Jean.
I think one way to avoid the danger is the problem.
Right.
Uh,
That's correct. And he's saying to have your study group have a focus, have it a defined focus, so that all know a content. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Oh, darned if I know. Now, children, you know, when we test children, when psychologists test children, we have to be very, very cautious because teenagers test crazy. They test schizophrenic. So you have to really know what you're doing because you're going to come up with, they're all crazy, we've got to go hospitalize them, because they are schizophrenic. So you have to have faith in the long-term growth of your child. You just have to have faith in their long term and look at their underlying behavior. I'm sorry, we have to stop if we can talk later.